problems with audio or video, just write in the chat. I'll be glancing at it as I go. But welcome everybody to the first time I've taught this course. I've just put together this new course on imperialism and anti-imperialism. Danny Sanchez actually gave me the idea when I was in his office at Mises University last summer, and it sounded like a good idea to me because there is a lot of literature in Austrian economics and Austrian political economy. Hans Hoppe calls it Austrian social theory. And so I thought, in light of world events and the ongoing march toward imperialism by the U.S. government especially, that it would be very relevant to teach a course like this and try to introduce some of the students to some of the ideas and literature and history of imperialism. And the focus, of course, is, if you look at the reading list, is American imperialism. Although the basic ideas, especially tonight when we talk about theory, mostly, as opposed to history and so forth, are universal as far as imperialism goes. And it is a vast topic. Many dozens, probably hundreds of books have been written about the subject. But I'm going to attempt to combine a bit of Austrian political economy or Austrian economics to the topic, and also history, and mostly in the context of the American example. Because after all, the U.S. government is the biggest imperialistic power in the world today by far. In the 20th century, the Soviet Union was a rival. In the 19th century, we had the British and Spanish and French, and among others. But in of course, 20th century, we had Germany and Russia and Japan and the U.S. But now it's primarily the U.S. So that's going to be our focus, I guess. Okay, and as I mentioned on the chat, if anyone wants a grade for the class, I'll make up a quiz or an exam after week two, and Danny will administer it online. And you usually have a couple of days to get around to it. And then also after week five, there'll be another one. And then that way, when you get your certificate of completion from the Mises Institute, you can have a grade or not. You don't need to do that. It's optional. Okay. So getting right into the substance of the class, I thought the way I would structure this five-week class was week one would be a discussion of some of the more theoretical aspects of imperialism from the Austrian literature, especially some of the ideas of Ludwig von Mises, Hans Hermann Hoppe, Joseph Stromberg, and Joe Salerno, who have all written very good articles, which I've put on the syllabus for tonight. And so, and by the way, sometimes some students don't recognize that there's a syllabus for the course. Everything is online, and that's the idea behind the Mises Academy courses. We try to make everything online, although there are a few courses where we ask students to buy books, such as my Road to Serfdom course, where we ask the students to buy a copy of famous book, The Road to Serfdom, by Friedrich Hayek. And I guess I'll start with one point I'd like to start with is something that von Mises mentions in this partial chapter of his that I put in the syllabus. And it's related to an article that I wrote a couple of years ago on lourockwell.com on the subject of what I called instigationism. And I guess I made up that word, instigationism. But I got kind of tired of people calling Ron Paul, among others, isolationists, because they seem to misunderstand one of the most basic fundamental points about economics, and that is an economy, a market economy that has a high degree of free international trade is essentially one big network or lattice work, as Murray Rothbard once called it, of individuals who all specialize in something. It's the international division of labor. And so that what the economy is, when we talk about the economy, is a network of hundreds or thousands or even millions of people all over the world, all of whom specialize in something, and we make money specializing in that one thing, and we use that money to buy goods and services, to buy food, clothing, shelter, and everything else from other people who specialize in different things. Think about how bad life would be if you had to grow all your own food, build your own house, manufacture your own car, make your own shoes, and so forth. We would all live like cavemen and cavewomen if that were the case. So it's the international division of labor that really that makes civilization work. And not only that, is that it always has been recognized that that trade promotes peace, because when you trade with other people, you recognize that it's to your mutual benefit to get along with these people. You don't have to like them, you don't have to love them, but you can benefit financially and otherwise from cooperating with people in the economic sphere. And also you do become more familiar with other people and other cultures through trade and commerce that crosses borders. And so it has been a tenet of classical liberalism, not modern day American liberalism, but classical liberalism, which meant freedom, that free trade, free international trade promotes peace. It doesn't guarantee peace, but it promotes peace. And so the true integrationists, the true internationalists are people like Ron Paul who advocate the old foreign policy of Thomas Jefferson of peaceful commerce with all nations, but entangling alliances with none. That was a famous paraphrase of Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address where he said that. And the same idea was enunciated in a different way by George Washington. Also, commercial relationships with all nations, entangling alliances with none. Keep your nose out of everyone's business. Don't get involved in the European wars, they were saying. And so the true internationalists are the people who advocate capitalism and freedom and international trade, whereas the people who are the real isolationists are the people who advocate war, aggressive war. The very people who are pointing their fingers, people on television, people in Congress, and so forth, who would point their fingers and criticize people like myself, or I keep mentioning Ron Paul because he's the most famous political figure in this regard. But their critics are the real isolationists, because war puts an end to the international division of labor. When people are fighting each other, they're not trading with each other. They're not benefiting in a mutual way, in a mutually advantageous way. They're killing each other, blowing each other up, and so forth, and they're not trading with one another. And so that's what isolation is. Even the threat of war leads to isolationism. People don't want to associate with or do business with people whose government is threatening to bomb them and occupy their country. And so Mises sort of brings this up in the first page of his readings of his. And I thought I would elaborate a little bit on this. And it's really the essential lesson of the famous article, famous among libertarians anyway, by Leonard Reed, entitled I, Pencil. It's also really the focus of much of Friedrich Hayek's work in Austrian Economics, to explain how an economy really crucially depends on decentralized knowledge in the minds of millions and millions of people who all specialize in something, performing some task, and in the pursuit of their own self-interest, they collaborate with other people to produce goods and services for us, and there need not be any central planner or any overseer to order us to produce so many cars or so many loaves of bread or anything else. And so that's the point number one I'd like to make here. And there's an excellent quote by von Mises about imperialism. Now, imperialism is just the opposite. Imperialism is the pursuit of war and conquest that breaks up internationalism and the familiarity with other people, other cultures, and other ways of doing business, for that matter. And I thought it's worth reading this great quote at the bottom of the first page, near the bottom of the first page of the article by von Mises that I put in the reading list, because it is just so telling and so full of knowledge. He says this about imperialism: for a fully developed imperialism, the individual no longer has value. He is valuable to it only as a member of the whole, as a soldier of an army, period. For the liberal, that is the libertarian he's talking about, The number of fellow members of his nationality is no unduly important matter. Doesn't matter. It is otherwise very different from imperialism. Under imperialism, it strives for the numerical greatness of the nation. To make conquests and hold them, one must have the upper hand militarily, and military importance always depends on the number of combatants at one's disposal. Attaining and maintaining a large population thus becomes a special goal of policy. The Democrat strives for the unified national state because he believes that this is the will of the nation. That's the Democrat. But the imperialist, on the other hand, he wants a state as large as possible. He does not care whether that corresponds to the desire of the people or not. The imperialistic people state scarcely differs from the old princely state in its interpretation of sovereignty and its boundaries. Like the latter, under the European princes, it knows no other limits to the expansion of its rule than those drawn by the opposition of an equally strong power, even if lust for conquest is unlimited. So that's the sharp distinction between imperialism and individualism. Under individualism, the focus is on respect for the individual as an individual and his rights to life, liberty, and property. Under imperialism, none of that matters. It's the expansion of the state for the glory of the state, and the individual is essentially a taxpayer and cannon fodder. And that's about it. And Mises goes on to say that he's giving a history lesson here, that the European imperialists prior to the Great War, prior to World War I, World War II, especially World War I, when they were imperialists, they sought to conquer people who they considered to be inferior human beings. They considered the Africans and Asians to be inferior to them, the Europeans. And so the excuse or the rationale or the overriding theory that they gave as a rationale or justification for their conquest was that these people were not yet developed highly enough to govern themselves. They needed to be governed by the Spanish Empire or the British Empire, or so it was said. And so that was the rationale or the theory that was given. And then Mises notes that once Germany became an imperial power, that changed because they began to conquer other Europeans. And so they needed a new rationale, a new theory for why they were doing what they were doing. And the new theory was what Mises calls the doctrine of the unified state. They began talking about the glories of the unified state. In America, Abraham Lincoln, long before the German imperialism became effective, talked about the mystical union. But that was his theory of the unified state, of the perpetual union. He used the word mystical to describe it somehow. And so I would argue that the imperialists of Germany in the early 20th century were taking their cue from Lincoln, who really was the first imperialist of the modern era, as far as I'm concerned. And to give you an example of why I think that way, I want to quote, believe it or not, I have some quotations here from Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. And this is from an old article of mine from 2002, May 2002, on lewrockwell.com, entitled Jaffa's Hitlerian Defense of Lincoln. It was 2 days after I debated a well-known Lincoln scholar, Harry Jaffa, on Lincoln, the issue of Lincoln. And I went and looked up because I had recalled that I had read Mein Kampf in college many, many years earlier. And there was a whole big section on states' rights and federalism. And it sort of stuck in my head, so I went out and got a copy of Mein Kampf. And I got the 1999 Mariner Houghton Mifflin edition of Mein Kampf, where Hitler paraphrases Abe Lincoln's first inaugural address, denying states' rights, state sovereignty, and Hitler glorified the centralized state. And so this is an example of what von Mises is talking about when he said the Germans developed a doctrine of the unified state. Well, I might as well take it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Here's what Adolf Hitler said in Mein Kampf, and you can get the page numbers and so forth if you want. from my article. He said this, here's Hitler in Mein Kampf talking about, paraphrasing Lincoln's first inaugural address. He said, quote, "The individual states of the American Union could not have possessed any state sovereignty of their own, for it was not these states that formed the Union. On the contrary, it was the Union which formed a great part of the so-called states," end quote. That was Lincoln's theory that he put forth, theory of the founding that he put forth in his first inaugural address. And of course, it was complete nonsense, logically and historically, because a union of two things cannot be older than the things themselves. That would be like saying a marriage could be older than either spouse, and that's impossible. So that a marital union cannot be older than either spouse, and neither can a union of the states be older than the states that form the union. And besides that, Article 7 of the U.S. Constitution proves that this is false, because it explains how the Constitution creating the American Union is to be formed. It says the Constitution is to be ratified by the free and independent states. And so Lincoln asserted a backwards theory. And here you have, years later, Adolf Hitler repeating the same theory to justify centralized governmental power in Germany. And he almost verbatim quoted Lincoln's first inaugural address. And here's what Lincoln said. "The Union is much older than the Constitution. It was formed, in fact, by the Articles of Association in 1774. It was matured and continued by the Declaration of Independence." And then I'm skipping along. "It follows from these views that no state upon its own mere motion can lawfully get out of the Union." So Lincoln said exactly what Hitler was saying, was that the Union somehow preceded the states. And in Mein Kampf, Hitler went on to mock the so-called, he called the states of Germany the so-called sovereign states, because they stood in the way of a centralized Reich. He said, and he mocked their, quote, "impotence" and, quote, "fragmentation." And he went on to say that the power of the central state in Germany is threatened by the struggle between federalism and centralization. So the two opposing sides are federalism or state rights on decentralized government on one hand versus centralization, which, of course, Hitler championed. And he claimed that this struggle between federalism and centralization was so shrewdly propagated by the Jews in 1919. That's Hitler talking. So he's echoing this. He said this is sort of a Jewish conspiracy, this idea of federalism, which, of course, is nonsense, but that's consider the source. And so, one more Hitler quote. He said, "Certainly all the states in the world are moving toward a certain unification." So he made the inevitability argument also. All the states in the world are moving toward the unified state, the unified centralized state. And that's what von Mises is talking about in this article when he refers to the doctrine of the unified state. So that's what was used in successive wars by Germany and other countries, including the American Civil War, long before World War I and World War II, by Lincoln, as I said. And for example, but this did not mean that the rationale that certain peoples are too incompetent to govern themselves was not used. Teddy Roosevelt tried to justify the killing of some 400,000, I believe, no, 200,000, sorry. Some 200,000 Filipinos by calling them savage beasts and making the American public think that these were just sort of wild beasts running around that we needed to tame and conquer and govern them. And so that argument did not disappear, but it was superseded for the most part by the doctrine of the unified state. Another important point that Mises makes here is he talks about the success of a lot of small states. Under imperialism, the assumption is always that, we need a big state to be successful. I can recall reading a few weeks ago something that Tom Woods wrote on his website. I think the article was probably reprinted on LouRockwell.com, where he's taking issue with some of the critics of nullification. And of course, Tom Woods has written a book on nullification, and I've written on, been writing about it for 15 years. And he was taking on some of the critics. And one of the points he made was they seem to think that the United States should never, ever, under any circumstances, be 1 inch smaller than it is today. And that's a good way to think of it. You know, what is so magical about the geographic size of the United States today that it's just unthinkable that it could never be 1 square inch smaller, let alone a square mile smaller. And so, but the fact is that there are a lot of very small states that have been very successful, and many of them have been much more successful than what the United States has become. And I guess the Soviet Union found out that a mega state is not necessarily the best thing in the world. And in this regard, I want to recommend one book to everybody in the class. It's, and I'll hold it up so you can see it in a minute. It's edited by Donald Livingston. And the book is a book of essays entitled Rethinking the American Union for the 20th Century, for the 21st Century. And this is, if you can see it on the screen there. And it's a series of essays on this whole topic of the size of states. And there are a couple of very interesting articles in there, one by Kirkpatrick Sale, who did a survey of just how big are all the different states in the world, different governments in the world. And there are quite a few that have just a couple million people. You know, the United States has, we're moving toward 350 million people. Even Thomas Jefferson in his day, more than 200 years ago, thought that the government, the country of his size was becoming ungovernable and making a mockery of the whole idea of democracy. And that was 200 years ago. And so it's really just is unworkable to think of democracy in any meaningful fashion with 350 million people. But in this old article by Mises, he talked about the success of some of the especially small states like Monaco, for example, and Liechtenstein. And that's an important point. But the imperialists seem to think that you need a mega state. And Mises connects this with the division of labor idea. Because you know, part of the history of the 20th century was that one of the reasons that Germany under the Nazis became so aggressive is they adopted an economic policy of autarky. That's spelled A-U-T-A-R-K-Y. And they tried to pursue economic self-sufficiency. And since Germany did not have enough resources to be self-sufficient in everything, they decided that they needed to conquer their neighbors to have one big giant Reich that would rule all of Europe and be self-sufficient, run by Hitler at the top. This is totally unnecessary to live a peaceful and prosperous life if you simply take advantage of the international division of labor instead. You don't need to grow everything and manufacture everything that you want or you need. It's ridiculous, frankly. I think you would destroy your society by doing that. And of course, Nazi Germany did its best to destroy German society and European society, as far as that's concerned. And so Mises reiterates his main point that imperialism never benefits the common man, which is why it is so remarkable that you see so many people in the United States, for example, constantly sitting at a bar cheering the military every time they look up at the television and see a bomb going off, wearing battleship ball caps and chanting USA, USA every time there's a bombing somewhere in some foreign country. And what's in it for them? It's more taxes, more controls, the abolition of civil liberties, and spying on us. But we'll talk next week, especially when we talk a little more about the ideas of Randolph Bourne, about why it is that so many people, once a war is started, accept all of these things that are unequivocally against their own self-interest, bad for them. Hans Hoppe has some very interesting ideas here also that I wanted to expose you to on imperialism. And he puts forth a sort of a straightforward, simple theory of the state expansion which is aimed at increasing the tax base. And that creates an inherent conflict with all other states, because other states want to increase their tax base too. So there's sort of this competition for taxpayers. Governments compete, as Hans Hoppe would say, for the right to plunder you. That's what competition in politics is. That's what a democracy is, basically. It's competition to see who gets the right to be the chief plunderer. And in terms of international competition, just the very nature of the state as an obsessive expander of its tax base leads to conflict with other states. And so, and states are inherently aggressive by their very nature. And one of the reasons for this, of course, is the imperative to constantly increase the tax base. They can never have enough money. And also the fact that the people who run the state can externalize the cost of any war. You don't see, for example, since I've been mentioning Lincoln, American history, Abe Lincoln's son was placed on General Ulysses S. Grant's staff a couple of months before the end of the American Civil War. So for the rest of his life, he could call himself a Civil War veteran, even though he was kept far, far away from any possible harm that could be done. And so, and also during that particular war, you could buy your way out of the draft in the United States, in the northern side of the war, for $300. So, and that was more than the average salary of a typical New York City dock worker at the time. And so if you were affluent enough, you could buy your way out. And so the people who run the state are typically of this sort, that isolate themselves and their children and grandchildren from the horrors of war. And Lincoln was very adept at doing this. Another interesting anecdote is that probably one of the biggest warmongering presidents America has ever had was Teddy Roosevelt, who was every neocon's favorite American president. But Teddy Roosevelt was no longer quite the warmonger after one of his own sons was shot down in World War I and killed. He was a fighter pilot, shot down and killed, and Teddy Roosevelt became somewhat of a pacifist after that. But the ruling elite usually do everything they can to isolate themselves from this. I guess one exception, when you see the history of the British royal family, when you see Prince Charles and his sons in the military, at least they've actually participated in the military as a part of the British Empire. And that's not universal. It's not universal. A lot of the, most of the functionaries of the state isolate themselves, and they can externalize the cost. And another important point that Hoppe makes is that the most successful imperialistic states are the ones who are wise enough to keep taxes low and moderate, because they understand that if you don't plunder the population too much, then the population will be more productive economically. And if it's more productive economically, there's more wealth to be extracted by the state. The wealth is produced and then the state can extract it. It's almost a supply side economics Laffer curve argument that Hoppe inadvertently makes here. But that's the idea. And when he makes this argument, it reminded me of another old article of mine that I wrote on lewrockwell.com years ago. The title of it was Statism, Imperialism, and Hubris. And it was a critique of the late Irving Kristol, who called himself the godfather of neoconservatism. And he did this in an article in his son's magazine, The Weekly Standard. And I wrote a critique of some of the things he said in this Weekly Standard article. And one of the things that Kristol mentioned was that one of the reasons the so-called neoconservatives supported Ronald Reagan as president was not because they knew anything about economics or they were concerned about economic policy, but they did understand that if you're going to have a world empire, if you're going to have be an imperialistic power, it takes a lot of money. And if tax cuts, the so-called Reagan tax cuts, could reinvigorate the economy, Irving Kristol said, then the neocons, neoconservatives are for the tax cuts because they know it takes a lot of money to be an imperialistic empire and to have the size of the military that they wanted to have, that they advocated. And so Hoppe mentions this idea that the most successful imperialistic states keep taxes relatively low. And of course, that means that the United States historically has become the biggest imperialistic power because of its history of, you know, compared to a lot of other places, relatively low taxes for long periods of time. Now, taxes in the United States were very high for a long period of time, also because of the wars especially, but compared to other states, the fact that they remained moderate allowed them to be become the world's biggest imperialistic power. Another important point, I think this is about the third important point I'd like to make regarding Hans Hoppe's theorizing, is the advocates and supporters of the modern imperialistic state in America claim that their basic theory is that they want to promote democracy in other countries because democracies do not war against each other. But Hans Hoppe points out that if you look at the sweep of history, wars after the advent of democracy, roughly since the French Revolution, 1789, have been far, far, far worse and more, with more killing and more destruction than the old wars under the European monarchs. Now, under the European monarchs, where the king essentially owned the property of the country, the kings were wise enough to not want to destroy their countries because they were essentially the owners. And the wars were mostly squabbles over territorial disputes, over inheritance disputes. There were wars between different kings and different princes, and they used mercenary armies for the most part. But once democracy came into being, then when one nation goes to war against another, you can still have an aggressive war and an imperialistic war. All of a sudden, the wars were defined as clashes of civilization. They became ideological wars. And as such, they were said to involve everybody, not just the king and his mercenaries. They involved everybody. And so once they involved everybody, then anyone is fair game in a war, civilians as well as combatants. And that's one of the horrible legacies of the democratization of war in the world. And there's a quote here. I'd like to use one of the quotes from the Mises article, where he says this, in wars of armies, the army does the fighting while the citizens who are not members of the army pursue their normal lives. He's referring here, he's quoting von Mises here. I'm quoting Ludwig von Mises. This is when the wars were, in history, were wars between monarchs. The citizens pay the cost of warfare. They pay for the maintenance and equipment of the army, but otherwise they remain outside of the war events. It may happen that the war actions raise their houses, devastate their land, and destroy their other property, but this too is part of the war cost which they have to bear. It may also happen that they are looted and incidentally killed by the warriors, says Mises, even by those of their own army. But these are events which are not inherent in warfare as such. They hinder rather than help the operations of the army leaders and are not tolerated if those in command have full control over their troops. A warring state which has formed, equipped, and maintained the army considers looting by the soldiers an offense. They were hired to fight, not to loot on their own. The state wants to keep civil life as usual because it wants to preserve the tax-paying ability of its citizens. Conquered territories are regarded as its own domain. The system of the market economy is to be maintained during the war to serve the requirement of warfare. And so that's a very telling quote by Ludwig von Mises about warfare in under the European monarch. And that all changed. That all changed with the advent of democracy. Democracy, wars under democracy became democratic battles, not just disputes. And so the war became nationalized. And among other things, what this means is that resistance to the war all of a sudden became treasonous. treasonous. Now, in the United States, this happened. The American Civil War was supposedly fought, among the reasons given of it was supposedly a war for government of the people, by the people, for the people, to paraphrase Abe Lincoln. Okay, and so now treason under the United States Constitution is defined as levying war upon the states or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. And the states, the United States, is defined in the plural. And that meant the free and independent and sovereign states. And giving aid and comfort to their enemies, this is Article 1, Section 3 of the United States Constitution. Giving aid and comfort to their enemies means the states. And so the treason is defined in the U.S. Constitution as doing exactly what Abe Lincoln did, levying war upon free and independent states, which, of course, is exactly what he did when he invaded the southern states. But then Lincoln himself redefined treason to essentially mean criticism of him and his administration, because it was supposedly a war for democracy, for a government of the people, by the people, for the people. So this should not perish from the earth, he said. And that, of course, was a ridiculous and stupid idea. Democracy would not have perished from the earth had the South been allowed to peacefully secede. There still would have been a democracy in the United States. There still would have been a democracy in the Confederate States. There still would have been democracy in England and France and so forth. And so that was just rhetorical BS. But a lot of people believe it and have fallen for it. And so, resistance to government, to war, was all of a sudden defined as treasonous. Conscription was imposed and tolerated. And so, even in the United States, for example, the 13th Amendment outlaws indentured servitude. But what else would you call military conscription but a form of servitude? And so, the Supreme Court, even during the World War I era, used some extremely convoluted language to proclaim that there was no conflict between the 13th Amendment and a conscription law, which is I think, nonsense, but that's what the Supreme Court said. Conscription certainly is a form of servitude. And so all distinction between the combatants and non-combatants essentially disappeared under the democratization of war. And in the 19th century, war had been evolving in such a way as that the countries of the world understood that war should be, governments should do everything they could to keep war confined to the combatants. Everyone understood that in a war, civilians will be harmed, their property will be damaged, but to intentionally murder civilians and bomb their homes and cities, that's a war crime. That was understood, and it was defined by international law, even at the time of the American Civil War, as a war crime. Even in his memoir, the famous American general William Tecumseh Sherman during the Civil War said that he was taught at West Point that the things that he did were war crimes, that you could be hanged for if found guilty of war crimes. But of course, the victors are never found guilty of anything, so that never happened. But this all changed, of course, and Lincoln was the progenitor of all this, who waged total war on his own country in the American Civil War. Hoppe uses some fiery language here, and he's saying all these things using the United States government as an example, and he calls it an arrogant, self-righteous, and zealous warmonger government. And to me, it's hard to dispute that, because the key word here, arrogant and self-righteous. Well, yes, that's the history of a lot of the aggressive warfare by the U.S. government. And to give you an idea why I agree with Papa on this, is there's a neat little book written by Robert Penn Warren in the early 60s. It's called The Legacy of the Civil War. Robert Penn Warren was a well-known novelist and poet. He wrote probably his most famous novel was All the King's Men. But he also wrote this great little book called The Legacy of the Civil War. And one of the things he says in there, he said, is that the legacy of the Civil War left the North, which is to say the U.S. government, with what he called a treasury of virtue. And here's how he puts it. The Northerner, with his treasury of virtue, feels redeemed by history. He has in his pocket not a papal indulgence peddled by some wandering pardoner of the Middle Ages, but an indulgence, a plenary indulgence, for all sins, past, present, and future. And then he goes on to say, but this is a poor basis for national policy, this idea that we are the most virtuous people on earth. That's American exceptionalism, in other words. The poor basis for national policy, Robert Penn Warren wrote, he says, but it is the justification for our crusades of 1917 to 1918 and 1941 to 1945 and our diplomacy of righteousness with the slogan of unconditional surrender and universal spiritual rehabilitation for others, end quote. And that's Robert Penn Warren describing American foreign policy in 1961 based on this idea that we were so righteous for having ended slavery and saved the Union and creating the unified state that anything we do in the future is righteous by definition because it is we Americans who are doing it. And that has been the central thinking of American foreign policy up to this very day. It's why one of my other articles, I quoted Barack Obama's second inaugural address where he threatened war with Syria and Iran and North Korea, and he did not use the Constitution as his justification or his legal permission. He used the political rhetoric of Abraham Lincoln, the rhetoric of righteousness, the rhetoric of continuing revolution, as the late Mel Bradford put it. Mel Bradford was the preeminent Lincoln critic of the last generation, and he wrote an essay, and he wrote a book with a whole bunch of essays in it. It's called A Better Guide Than Reason, the book is. And one of the essays in it, he talks about the rhetoric of continuing revolution, and that's what he's referring to. He's referring to this treasury of virtue idea that Robert Penn Warren wrote about in his little book, The Legacy of the Civil War. Hoppe also takes on this idea of democratic peace. And the neoconservatives and the supporters of the American empire today think that they have, quote, scientific evidence that democracies do not war against each other. And it is true, you don't see England and France warring against each other anymore like they did hundreds of years ago, and you don't see much of that at all. But Hoppe's take on this is that it's not democracy per se that is the reason why these countries are not warring against each other. But he says this, that the United States hegemon did not allow its puppets or its satellites to war against each other. So in other words, all these countries are essentially either bribed or threatened by the U.S. government foreign policy apparatus to behave themselves, to not war against each other, since they're all part of the American empire de facto. And the argument that Hoppe makes is that, well, you know, the Soviet satellite countries, they did not war against each other either. Czechoslovakia did not invade other parts of the Soviet Empire and vice versa during the Cold War years. But Hoppe asked, does that mean that communism is inherently peaceful? Well, of course not. But that's essentially the argument the neoconservatives are making. Democracy is inherently peaceful. But the Soviet satellites did not war on each other because the Soviet Union would not allow them. It would have brought the tanks in and ended that right away. And Hoppe argues, so would the U.S. government, and I believe it would. And so he argues that it's a myth that liberty, that democracy is necessarily peaceful. The biggest democracy, one of the biggest democracies in the world, of course, is the United States, and it's been engaging in aggressive wars all over the world for many, many years. Another thing that's a bad idea, though, Hoffa mentions here is the myth that liberty means democracy. How ridiculous is that? Is that liberty necessarily means democracy? And I couldn't help but digging out some information on this point that, Woodrow Wilson claimed to plunge the United States into World War I because he wanted to help overthrow the European monarchies and impose democracy, because democracy was supposed to bring a new world, the end to war, the war to end all wars and all that. But it was a war to make the world safe for democracy. But listen to the kind of democracy that existed in the United States under Woodrow Wilson, the man who wanted to impose his system of democracy on the rest of the world at gunpoint. And I'm quoting from my article that was on the Mises Daily today, actually, The Virus of Imperialism, Part 2, about Wilson's war in World War I. The Espionage Act of 1917 imposed $10,000 fines and as much as 20 years in prison for anyone saying or doing anything the state construed as discouraging enlistments in the military. The Sedition Act of 1916 imposed similar criminal penalties for any type of criticism of the government. All printed materials were censored, thousands were deported without due process of law, and state-sponsored vigilante groups conducted warrantless searches and seizures in the United States. The author Upton Sinclair was arrested for reading the Bill of Rights in public. Poet E.E. Cummings was imprisoned for 3.5 months for writing a letter to his mother while he was in the Army, saying that he did not necessarily hate Germans. In New Jersey, a man named Roger Baldwin was arrested for reading the Constitution in public. So this was the type of, quote, democracy that existed in America under Woodrow Wilson, the man who claimed that he wanted to force the countries of Europe to adopt this system of democracy. And so it seems farcical, doesn't it, when you look at it that way. Continuing on the theme about democracy here, Joe Salerno, in the article that I also put on tonight's list by him, he starts off talking about John C. Calhoun. He mentions Calhoun. And Calhoun was considered by Murray Rothbard to be probably America's best political philosopher. Certainly, he called him many times one of America's most prominent or best political philosophers, primarily because of his book, A Disquisition on Government, that was published after his death. And one of the things Calhoun did in this book, A Disquisition on Government, was to give a rendition of what's called libertarian class theory. And libertarian class theory is different from Marxian class theory. Marxian class theory is it claims that there's an inherent conflict between the working class and the capitalist class. Well, the conflict under libertarian class theory, which goes back to the 1600s, it wasn't invented by John C. Calhoun by any means. There were the French physiocrats of the 1600s wrote about this, and among others. But anyway, the two classes are the net taxpayers, class number one. These are people who pay more in taxes than they get in government benefits. The other class is the net tax consumers, people who get more from government than they pay in taxes. Government bureaucrats, politicians, people who get lots of government subsidies, these are the net tax consumers. And so government in a democracy, said Calhoun and Salerno, who's talking about him, is a matter of fomenting this nonstop conflict between the taxpayers and the tax consumers. And what war and imperialism do, is to disguise this inherent class conflict that is inherent in all democracies. Because war gives us, for example, an excuse for all sorts of emergency taxes. And so war is used as an excuse to impose all kinds of taxes that are really used as part of this game of plundering the net taxpayers for the benefit of the net tax consumers. And so war makes it easier for the parasite class, the people who live off the producers, to further plunder the producer class or the producing class. And so permanent war, or even the threat of war, the permanent threat of war, is really optimal from the perspective of what you might call the parasite class, the class of people who live off the work of other people, live off the tax dollars of other people. And so a war, of course, also always leads to high levels of debt and inflation eventually. And both debt and inflation hide the cost of government. They hide the cost of war, and they hide the cost of all other government programs too, because if you directly tax people for wars, you're going to get a lot more resistance to the war, and the wars that exist are going to be a lot shorter. But if you can delay the tax bill up 20 or 30 years into the future by issuing debt to pay for it, or if you can print money and create price inflation and then blame the price inflation on greedy capitalists, well, then the politicians can get away with separating themselves from the costs of war to a very large extent. And so those are some of the main points I think that are salient that Salerno makes about war and imperialism from an economic perspective. And I guess the final point I'll make is about some of the things we're going to talk about in the class is mentioned by Joseph Stromberg, who's done a lot of writing in this whole area. I have several articles by Joe Stromberg on the syllabus. And I put this one on that's on there for tonight, because it's only like, what, 8 or 9 pages, but he makes the case that it's important to distinguish between what the Marxists have been saying about imperialism from an economic perspective for many, many years and the Austrians. The Marxists latched on to this theory of excess production many, many, many years ago, where they're basically the theory is under capitalism, there will be surpluses. They'll produce too much stuff. And so as a way of getting rid of all this stuff, the capitalists will get the government to force it upon foreign countries so that the government is constantly conquering other countries and in order to set up markets where the capitalists can sell their excess goods. But the fatal flaw in the argument is that there are not surpluses in every industry, to be sure, under capitalism. And two, whenever there are surpluses, it's caused by government policies such as agricultural subsidies, protectionist tariffs, and so forth. And that's not capitalism. That's mercantilism or crony capitalism that causes that. So there's nothing inherent in capitalism that creates surpluses of goods. It's really a perversion of capitalism by protectionism and corporate welfare and things of that sort that create surpluses in some industries that are protected from competition like that. So in a sense, the empire or imperialism is simply the state writ large. It's usually an attempt by the state to impose on another country some sort of system of crony capitalism or mercantilism, but not real capitalism, not mutually advantageous trade among consenting adults, which is what real capitalism essentially is. And so so that's another important point to make, that there is nothing inherent about capitalism that it creates surpluses. It's interventionism that creates surpluses in some industries, but not all. And maybe I'll stop there. The usual routine is for me to talk for about 45 or 50 minutes, and then I do my best to answer any questions that you have on the chat or on the Q&A section. And so, I'll do my best. I can't promise I can answer every question, but I'll sit here for a while and stare at the chat or the Q&A and see if I can detect any questions. It's not mandatory, of course. If you don't have questions, you don't have questions. Feel free. I see Cam is doing his usual great job. Let's see, Carl is talking about a vicious circle. I'm not sure what kind of circle, Carl. More land for more population for more soldiers, yes. More land for more taxpayers. And then some of the taxpayers are used to finance more soldiers. That's under imperialism. That's what imperialism is. He also makes a point that this is not necessary for prosperity, to be sure, because you can take advantage of the International Division of Labor instead. I guess what Mises is saying there is, if we understand economics better and understand in his day, must have been so horrifying to him, having spent his life teaching and researching economics, and then to see it all go up in smoke in his homeland by these thugs and ignoramuses who thought that the way to wealth was a sort of medieval conquest of their neighbors rather than peaceful trade and exchange. And of course the war had a lot to do with that. World War One, and especially the American entry into World War One, and the imposition of the reparations on Germany, really strengthened the hand of the Nazis. It was so harmful to Germany that the German people actually allowed someone like Hitler to come to power when they still had democracy in Germany. And when he came to power, there was still democracy in Germany. And so the Wilson's War had that effect. In fact, there's a very good book about it by Jim Powell called Wilson's War, where Jim Powell makes a very powerful case that the effect of World War One, the American entry into World War One, was to strengthen the hand of both the Nazis and the communists in the subsequent years. If Carl says, he's talking about drones and robots. He doesn't see what purpose we do this in the Middle East. Well, one of the things we're going to read, that when you get to the Randolph Warren article, War is the Health of the State, one of the points he makes is that foreign policy is always made by maybe a couple of dozen people in a closed room somewhere in secret. And we, the people, have nothing to do with it. Our representatives in Congress have nothing whatsoever to do with it. It's solely the executive branch, and it's all done in secret. And when we ask them questions about it, they say, sorry, this is classified information. That's why they're so upset and hysterical over Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks and these whistleblowers who have shined a light a little bit on all their conniving and war-making and imperialism and so forth. And so, I don't know why we're constantly threatening to kill people in the Middle East. It usually has something to do with natural resources and our acquisition of them by force, or the refusal of some of these countries, or the threat of some of these countries to quit using the dollar and using their own currency or some other currency. It usually has something to do with that. It usually has something to do with a never-ending quest for the American military-industrial complex to keep the gravy train going. The end of the Cold War was a disaster for them, and so they immediately had to start finding new boogeymen, new Hitlers out there, whether it was our old ally, Saddam Hussein, or another old ally, Manuel Noriega from Panama, or whoever. They had to be turned into Hitlers to justify more wars for whatever reason. Let's see, Diego is asking me about the Catholic Church as an anti-war force. Well, the Pope has been warning against war, and he does every time. Every time an American president threatens to bomb somebody else, the Pope always comes out in opposition to it. Murray Rothbard was an atheist. He grew up in a Jewish family in New York City, but he also said, and it's in writing somewhere, he thought that the teachings of the Catholic Church were an important part of the glue that held human civilization together, the teachings of the Catholic Church, not any particular Catholic clergyman or even the Pope, but the teachings of the Church that have been embraced by so many people. And so I think you could certainly make a case that the Catholic Church has done both. I mean, over Rocket's history, you know, there was the Inquisition after all, and there was opposition to the Catholic Church by a lot of governments. There's a famous story, at least famous among some Austrian economists, that there was a Dominican priest in Spain, in Salamanca, Spain, who understood the economics of his day, way back in the 16th century, I believe it was, who wrote the Pope and said that, he wrote the King of Spain, the King of Spain a letter saying that the King of Spain had been coin clipping. He had been confiscating people's gold coins and melting them down and giving them back to the people, supposedly, of the same value, but with some of the gold missing and replaced with some lesser metal. And this Dominican priest wrote a letter to the King of Spain saying, you're robbing from the people, and it hurts the poor people the most because they're the people who can afford the least to be robbed. He was imprisoned. And the Pope himself, at the time, wrote the King of Spain and said, either disprove his theory or let him out of jail. And he let him out of jail. So there's a long history of the Catholic Church getting involved on the side of freedom and against imperialism and confronting the kings. And so, but the big expert on the Catholic Church among the Austrians is Tom Woods. Tom Woods has written several books on the Catholic Church. The Church in the Market is one of them. And so I would recommend that. I'm not the expert on that question. Tom Woods is. See, Caleb is saying, I mentioned the possibility of the country giving up land. How could this be possible? Well, it happened in the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union seceded, there were, a dozen or so different acts of peaceful secession. That's how the Soviet Union broke up. If the American Union broke up into, say, 10 or 12 different republics, hopefully some of them would be more freedom-oriented. And if you wanted to have the Communist Republic of Washington, D.C., fine, have at it. Enjoy yourself, but keep me out of it would be my attitude. And so Thomas Jefferson, way back in the 1820s, shortly before his death, was asked by a friend if he thought the American Union would survive. And he thought it was likely that it would be broken up into several different confederacies. And he said they would all be our children, meaning philosophically our children. And he said we would wish them all well. He didn't threaten invasion and bloodshed like Abe Lincoln did in his first inaugural address of any state that seceded. He said we would wish them all well. And so that's how it could happen. Peaceful secession is what we're talking about. And it was, of course, the state would have to be forced into it. The Soviet Union, socialism finally bankrupted it. Socialism always bankrupted the Soviet Union, but they had enough built-up capital to live on, and they conquered enough other countries to live on their capital that the Soviet government survived for quite a long time. But eventually, it simply collapsed of its own weight and could no longer enforce its empire. Norbert is asking if there's any real chance for the U.S. to stay within its original intention of true liberty, or is the nature of any form of government to be against liberty? Yes, that is the nature of any government, to be against liberty. And so, and the American founders understood this. That's why they thought it to be restrained by a constitution, but the opponents of that, led by Alexander Hamilton, went to work subverting and undermining the Constitution from the very beginning. I write about this in great detail in my book, Hamilton's Curse. So at least in the United States example, there always was a faction that wanted to bring some version of European mercantilism and statism and interventionism and imperialism here. They wanted America to be an empire like the British Empire. Then you had the Jeffersonians who said, no, we want an empire of liberty. So there always was that tension or that conflict between the two political views in the United States. And the Constitution was never enough. a book that I mentioned in my talk, A Disquisition of Government on Government by John C. Calhoun, one of the main points is that a written constitution would never be enough to limit the tax-consuming class. You need something more. And one of the things Calhoun proposed was what he called a concurrent majority. He wanted to give a state or a group of states the constitutional ability to veto what they believed was unconstitutional federal legislation. He feared that the day would come when the federal government would become the sole arbiter of constitutionality, which it did come after the American Civil War. But before the American Civil War, presidents issued an opinion on the constitutionality of legislation. Congress did. People of the states did. But it became a monopoly of the government after the Civil War. And so and the Civil War destroyed the right of nullification and the right of secession, or even the threat of secession disappeared for the most part. And so the people of the states no longer had any control over the federal government after that, after 1865. And so the old Jeffersonians warned that if that day ever came, the federal government, through its own judiciary, would be the sole arbiter of constitutionality, then America would be a tyranny. And that day came roughly 1866, when the states and the people of the states, through their representatives, no longer had any meaningful say over constitutionality. For example, in Judge Andrew Napolitano's book, The Constitution in Exile, he points out that not one single federal law was ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court between 1937 and 1995. So the Supreme Court has become, for the most part, a rubber stamp of anything the state ever wants to do, even Obamacare. Yeah, where is that in the Constitution? Let's see. And Bob wasn't if I care to comment on the Syrian crisis. Well, the crisis is an American crisis. It's Obama and some of the Republicans like McCain and Lindsey Graham who just cannot get enough war. They just can't get enough war. The Syrians have done nothing to us. They can do nothing to us. They don't intend to do anything to us, Americans. It's none of our business, which is probably why I've seen opinion polls that say that at least 3/4 of the public is against any kind of intervention there. And so I'm not an expert on Syria, but that's my comment on for now on the Syrian crisis, I guess. Let's see, Bob wants to know, why does the U.S. support the Middle Eastern oil cartels versus fracking and U.S. oil independence? Well, you know, I don't know if any of you remember, I remember seeing when President Bush was in office and he escorted his good friend, one of the princes of Saudi Arabia, to his ranch in Texas. And they greeted each other like old lovers who hadn't seen each other in a long time. Dick Cheney was there. And so a lot of American business elites have long had connections with the Arab oil cartels and through their refineries that they own. It's no accident that the Bush family is from Houston, Texas, where the oil refinery capital of America is located, and that they have close relations to the Middle East despots. The first President Bush went to war, supposedly to defend his friends, the dictators of Kuwait, who they also have business dealings with. And so it's not unusual to see U.S. government policy propping up or supporting them. And by the way, the first war in the Persian Gulf in the early 90s, There was no economic threat to America. There was all this hysteria about, oh, the price of gas will be at $30 a gallon. But Saddam Hussein, as evil as he was, if he had taken over Kuwait, all that would have happened was that we would have had a different dictator selling us Kuwaiti oil. Instead of the Kuwaiti dictator selling us that oil, Saddam Hussein, the dictator, would have been selling us the exact same oil at the exact same price. And so so it wasn't a matter of harming America, you know, what was going on over there. It was a matter of defending a friend of the Bush family, essentially, who they had business dealings with. There's a good article, Fighting for Oil, by Rothbard, that Danny put on the site there. Let's see. Any more questions? We're slowing down. The first class, the people aren't too inquisitive, I guess. It's okay. Well, if not, I guess we can call it a night. We've been sitting here for an hour and 15 minutes. Seem to be running out of gas. Okay, well, thanks for participating. I hope you learned a few things tonight. And we're going to be talking about some really interesting stuff in the next couple of weeks. And we're going to be watching world events, too, that are going to be very much in sync with what we're talking about in this class. And we'll see you all next week. Thanks. Haven't read Mark Levin's book. I can't stand the thought of giving him money. Somebody, Bob Shaw, asked me about that.